Welcome in to the hour. We're blessed to be joined by Tyler again this week.
Happy to be a blessing.
Yeah. Last week, you surprised me, man. It was fun. I had a blast last week. Coaches, if you haven't seen that one, I would recommend going back and viewing that one. That one was great.
Agreed.
You know, we always like to use this time to talk about what we're seeing in the game and what's coming up on consulting calls or in our community chat. And with this season, with Tyler running the February cohort on winning at the right time, very timely that a lot of coaches are reaching out about late game practices, game plans, how to handle. Some coaches go through a long break. I had a call today where the coach is going to play today and won't play again until next Friday. So a lot to navigate. Tyler, you had talked and I think week two or week one of the cohort about aligning your identifying your best weapon and identifying your opponent's best weapon. And I love that. What we always tried to do game plan wise was look at which strengths of ours align with our opponent's weaknesses and can we double down or go deep into those. So ideas that we would look for or keys that we would look for would be, you know, we are really good in transition, or we like transition and their transition defense is really poor. Let's make sure that transition is a key to winning the game. Or maybe we're a really deep team and they aren't. So how do we maximize our depth against their lack of depth? What has been, curious to hear this from you, what has been something that has been surprising to you, maybe that coaches overthink, underthink as far as prepping in the playoffs?
You know, I think the overthink that I've observed is this arbitrary pressure to change just for change's sake. It's like, okay, now we're in playoffs. We have to change it up, which I don't think is where one should start, like from the need to change. I think you said it very well. It's let's reassess, but let's not necessarily start from the default of change. I would actually suggest start from the default of stay the same. You're there for a reason. You know, you've been successful for a reason. Double down on your strengths.
Yeah.
So I think that would be, oh, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, I completely agree. And I sympathize with coaches because I've been there before. And when the weight of win or go home is on you, you feel like you have to overcoach and prepare for every single thing. Or, you know, we saw them, you know, play this defense or do this against this opponent. So we have to install something for that. I think a better way to look at it, and something I did later in my head coaching career, was what do we already do that we can tweak? Or instead of changing our identity, because you're not doing that late in the season, what can we refine? So what can we just cut deep in our preparation? And one way we did that, and one way I think coaches can help stay streamlined and stay on task, I think the easiest thing for coaches to do is to get distracted, is to identify, obviously, keys to winning. I think that's on everybody's scouting report. And we can probably talk scouting reports too. But narrowing those keys to be really, really specific, and even come up with a key to losing. So we called it a pre-mortem. I think coaches do a pretty good job, or all coaches can leave a game and say, oh, we lost because of this, right? That would be like post-mortem after the game. Very easy. We didn't get good enough shots, or we fouled too much, or we didn't, you know, we got good shots, just didn't make them. But I always thought it was helpful to look before the game and run through the game in your head and say, okay, if we were going to lose this game, why? What's the one thing that really sticks out? Sometimes it's something like, man, we come out flat, or we come out timid because it's the playoffs and maybe we're in a round of the playoffs we haven't been in before. And then maybe it's something like if we cannot rebound with this team because they're bigger and stronger, that would be basically our pre-mortem, which is really just a key to losing. But I think a big part of keys is being more specific. Like I said, most coaches that I have talked to, and I'm interested to hear if you've had this same, is we'll say like, what do you think your keys are winning? And they'll be like, oh, well, this team shoots the three really well, so we got to defend the three-point line. I think that's like the surface layer of it. And I think if you were to go deeper, questions I always find myself asking either coaches I consult with or when I was coaching, asking myself is, okay, well, like they shoot the three well, or they've got two players that really shoot the three well. How do they get those threes? Is it drive and kick? Do they get those off screens? Do they get those off set plays? Because that can help really narrow your focus on where your preparation can go for the game.
Yeah, I like that. That's really good. You know, in the postseason, as the pressure mounts, most teams and most players probably play a little worse. Most teams and most players don't often play better. And so I think that if one were to ask themselves, why would a player or our team play worse, and then try to remove those obstacles to success, you probably would have better performance as opposed to trying to add or adjust. Really just, can you do what you do well? So, you know, pressure, can you spend a little bit of time on mental preparation? Can you spend a little bit more time on, you know, building belief and confidence? Can you try to eliminate those things that might work against weaker teams and weaker opponents, but probably won't work against the best opponents, which is really what you're trying to do all season long? And so that's why I think removing options instead of adding options generally leads to more postseason success. Like, I think an example of this is, we already know what the Denver Nuggets are going to do in the postseason. Everybody does. They're going to run more two-man game with Jamal Murray and Nikola Jokic. That's not a surprise to anyone. What they're going to eliminate is, they're probably going to eliminate more Aaron Gordon three-point attempts. They're probably going to eliminate more off-the-dribble creation by Kentavious Caldwell-Pope. They're probably going to limit minutes off the bench for Christian Braun. So, like, the best teams that perform in the postseason actually eliminate things as opposed to add new things. And I think that would be a better approach, is to see what you can trim back as opposed to what you can add.
Yeah. The whole idea of more is not better. Less, mm-hmm. Do less, but better. Right. And I think as coaches, we have a tendency to, if we have a problem, let's say to beat this team, we've got to, I don't know, get our best player more touches or whatever it is. It's okay, what can we add in order to accomplish that, instead of mm-hmm. what do we currently do? What can we do better to accomplish that? So in the playoffs, if that's more two-man game with Jamal Murray and Jokic, then it's not install a bunch of stuff for them. It's, they already play a bunch of two-man game, and it's beautiful when they do it. Just do it more, right? Mm-hmm. And do it better. I want to go back to something you said, because I feel like this is so true, and it's almost like I've been scared to say it or acknowledge it, but teams do play worse in the playoffs, especially at the high school level. I felt like you mentioned two things. I think you said, what can you do to give your team more confidence or to alleviate pressure? Do you think it's mostly mental that teams don't play well in the playoffs, or is there a mix of mental, physical, a bunch of different factors? What's the key takeaway there?
You know, I would argue that everything's mostly mental. You know, I would argue everything's mostly mental. And so if I were to identify three things that we can do as a coach or a leader to help our teams perform their best at all times, but specifically in moments of high pressure, all right, here'd be number one, supermodeling. Most coaches act different in the postseason than they do throughout the game. They act different in their practices leading up to the game, right? They're more on edge. We act different when we're going through film. We've really got to watch out for this. Like, it almost creates a sense of fear. Like, they're so good at this, okay? Yep. Right? It creates a sense of fear. And then even in the games, like, you watch a coach on the sideline in a high-pressure game at the end of the season versus, like, a preseason game, their whole demeanor is different. And so, like, coaches, like, act as if you've been there before, even if you haven't. you know, because your energy is going to be the energy your teams play with. And I see this all the time in the club AAU scene. Like the personality and the energy of the coach on the sideline, that's how their team plays. Like if it's really boisterous, like in your face energy, then that's how the team plays. If it's really like angry and frustrated energy, that's how the team plays. If it's really like just like joyful teaching energy, learning, that's how the team plays. And so like model, you know, Gandhi, be the change you want to see. So that'd be one. Two, I would say instead of build up your opponent, I would say build confidence in what you do. Like, hey, when we run our lock left, like tell the future. When we run our lock left and really dial it in, it is going to frustrate this point guard so much because they are used to being able to go to their right hand. And when they get frustrated, that's when we break it open. And like, just keep telling the story in advance, that create the narrative that's more about your team and less about fear of what the other team is doing. I think I maybe mentioned this on a recent cohort call. I don't know. I'll say it again. Maybe it was with you, but my college coach, Hall of Fame coach, like he just stopped doing scouts altogether and said, we don't care about what they do. He's like, our offense is so good. It's won 2 national championships, right? We average over 80 points per game. He's like, if we just run our offense, they can't stop it. There's nothing they can do to stop it. So let's not even worry about it. And we just like went in with extreme confidence. It was probably unfounded, yeah. But extreme confidence, because then we actually ran into the lock left Carleton University in the national tournament, and we couldn't run our offense, and I was frustrated, so I was that guy. And then the third thing I think that you can do is actually like build a mental toughness routine. So for your players, like there's going to be moments, especially in high pressure games, where the other team goes on a run, or you miss 5 shots in a row, or the referees give you 5 bad calls, or your best player's in foul trouble, whatever. And then if in that moment you react, reactions are always negative, but a response is something that you plan in advance. And so if you can actually build a mental toughness routine, meaning that you put players in tough or challenging situations in practice, or you prepare them in like a pre-practice sort of just a visualization thing, and say, this happened, let's all prepare our response to this moment. Okay, visualize it for 30 seconds. Okay, now this happened. And then go out on court and say, okay, starters, you only have 4 players for the next 2 minutes of the scrimmage, right? And I want you to choose your response to this unfair situation, because we're going to face an unfair situation. So like you build up mental toughness as a muscle, just like you do, you know, physically build muscles. You've got to actually tear yourself apart and tear the cells apart. So I think those are 3 things you can do to maybe have a little bit better performance.
Yeah. We had a team psychiatrist come and talk to us when I was in college, and he showed, you know, the importance of visualization. Whenever you are visualizing yourself doing something, and when you're actually mm-hmm. doing it, your brain does not know the difference. Mm-hmm. And he showed us kind of the map of your brain and how things are firing in your brain. I don't know the science behind it, but it was amazing to see that. And I was taking my daughter to volleyball tryouts a couple months ago. And on the way there, I just said, hey, we're almost there. Spend like 30 seconds. Just close your eyes and picture yourself doing things well. Just something routine, mm-hmm. like passing or setting or hitting the ball. And she thought I was crazy. But I think there's a ton of value in that. And I will 100% agree and echo response versus reaction. And one thing that I did to kind of dial that in, and it goes with the second point you were making as far as preparing your team for the playoffs, as far as building yourself up instead of building them up against a really good team, it was always pump confidence into our team. I want them to feel really good about what we're doing, about our preparation, even if it's not good, because a lot of times players don't know the difference, right? We see it completely different. And then if we were playing against a team in the regular season where I felt like we could probably make a lot of mistakes and win this game, I was harder on them. So the standard stays the same, but your response can be one predetermined, but it can still be different. So that's kind of when we would, you know, we would hammer them a little bit more, because I wanted them to feel me, like you said, they're going to know. I wanted them to feel that I was on edge a little bit, because we got to get better. But going into those better games, I also wanted them to feel like, hey, I'm really confident in you as players and in our game plan as well. And you mentioned scouts, not doing scouts. Man, my scouts looked so different over the years, where I really took it as, all right, what do they do? Let's say they run a lot of sets. Like they screen really well off the ball. We're going to have to guard, defend a lot of different actions. Well, we switch everything. So what's important to us is that we switch well. So less of what they do, more of how we defend it, to where all week long they're hearing, you know, how we defend everything. And let's say a big part of switching is talk, touch, take, right? So pregame talk or on the scout, you could talk, you could, you know, they're going to see talk, touch, take. But I think pregame, hey, turn to the person next to you and tell them what are our three keys in our switching, and get them talking it, right? And it should be something that they really should be echoing what you've said all during your prep. So I've told coaches, and the way we did it towards the end of my time coaching was really the scout just becomes what we've been talking about all week. I used to be very guilty of, well, we didn't get to this, so let's put it on the scout and make sure that they know it. And I think that goes back to keys too. Can your keys be related to what you want your team to be to do instead of what the opponent does, right? And making those really specific. I get a lot of, you know, transition defense has to be good. Well, then what part of that? You know, do they have a point guard that pitches ahead really well? Or do they have a point guard that just goes coast to coast, is a bull in the full court? Well, if it's that point guard that goes coast to coast, well, then instead of transition defense being the key would be slow the ball or turn the ball. And we could, you know, make that really measurable. The ball has to turn at least once in the backcourt, or in the lock left. It would be, can we at least get that?
Give me the sideline. Yeah.
Yes. Can we side the ball, get him going left?
Mm-hmm. And for our lock left coaches, for 90%, and this is like just going deep into lock or deeper into lock left based on like your turn the ball thing. So the lock left is the most effective against the lowest level of opponent. And the lock left will be the least effective against the highest level of opponent, especially the ones that can be explosive and dynamic both ways, right? But for 90% of coaches across the world of basketball, lock left is going to be very effective. And just locking left actually results in a similar outcome to turning the ball. Because when most players at most levels of play, especially as the games get higher and higher pressured, when they take two dribbles left and near the sideline, they turn themselves without the defender having to be any good. And so it's like we're trying to get the same outcome with just a different with just a different method. So I just wanted to frame that up for everybody as well. I'm just going to mark this clip here because I think the point that you made was really, really good. I'm attempting to summarize it in just a sound bite. When preparing for an opponent, identify the thing that you want to prepare for, but then don't tell your team that you're trying to take that opponent's strength away. Tell your team that we are going to improve our ball screen defense. You don't need to even reference because it's of the strength of the other team, because when you reference an opponent's strengths, you see doubt in your own team. But when you just say, this is something that's a part of our identity that's going to help us win the game, you're actually building confidence. And as you grow in mastery or improve your communication or effectiveness on your ball screen defense, let's say, then your team grows in confidence. It's all just framing. And I would even just finish to say that the majority of coaching is framing. It's not in, like, every coach can recognize that we need to improve our ball screen defense, but how you frame it to your team will determine their level of buy-in, their level of belief, the clarity with which they understand their jobs and roles, the amount of energy that they bring to it, and whether they're confident in it or afraid of it. It's all in your framing. Coaching is sales. You're selling your vision. And if people buy your vision, you'll be successful. If your team doesn't buy your vision, you won't. The majority of coaches that that I've worked with or observed that I've seen fail, they don't often fail because of a lack of basketball knowledge or even poor systematic choices. They fail because they aren't a leader that is able to charismatically hold the standard, persuade the group, get the stakeholders, you know, your parents and your AD on board with the vision. I mean, you could have a terrible business plan and still be incredibly successful. Look at all the Ponzi schemes that have been successful throughout history, right? Right. So it's really coaching to sales. And I think that's a tool in the coaching toolbox that coaches should spend a lot more time on. Take a public speaking class, study sales book, go read StoryBrand or a marketing book and apply that to your coaching. I think you'll see your influence grow with your team even more so than if you learn a new defensive system.
Yeah. I love the term framing too. I hate to say I get pushback here, but I think at this time of year, and really all year, but especially in the playoffs, we encourage coaches to focus on themselves, right? Your identity. It doesn't mean we're not preparing for our opponent. So I love the example you used of, hey, we need to improve our ball screen defense, knowing that our opponent is going to ball screen us. Mm-hmm. We don't have to say the second part. We don't have to say they're really good in the ball screen. We're focused on our ball screen coverage to prepare for our opponent. So I think there's a misconception that if you focus on yourself, you're not preparing your team to win. I think the difference is exactly what you said. It's just how you frame it to your team.
Yeah. And I'll even go a step further and argue that the majority of what coaches say to their teams are just status games, both in game prep and in game debriefs. And here's what I mean by status games. A status game is one is motivated by raising their status or standing in the eyes of others. And a lot of times we're trying to raise our status or standing in the eyes of our team or the eyes of the stakeholders, the parents or the administration or assistant coaches, right? So we want to let them know our entire process. I've watched hours of film on these guys and I've studied all the da-da-da and they do this and this and this and look how much that I've known, I've thought about, right? But the only thing that your team needs to know is what do they do? And if you really want to be concise and clear with your messaging, then just say, this is what we do to win. They don't need to know your whole process because that's just going to confuse them and see doubt in their mind. And so really, I would encourage coaches to source, okay, why am I talking to them for 30 minutes after a game? Really, you're just having your own verbal debrief so that you feel good and you're emptying your brain at them so that you can go to sleep at night. They don't care. They want to go, you know, kiss their girlfriend. Yep. You know, like no one's learning anything in post-game debriefs.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And you're usually wrong.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And then we go watch the film and we're like, well, maybe I overreacted a bit there. Right. Yeah. I love, you know, when you talked about the status game, 80-20, right? So they probably need to know 20% of what you know about the scout. Making those very clear, very concise, if we give them at all. One thing I started doing, coaches might be able to adapt this, is I would go screen record and go through game plan 2.5 minutes. Send it to them. Hey, watch this before tomorrow's practice. They got the scout 2.5 minutes. They can rewatch it if they want. Also, I think your scouting report, focus on, we could come up with 10 different things that this opponent does, right? You mentioned ball screen. Maybe they're good in transition. Maybe they run this set. Okay, but like, where do they score from? So they might run a lot of sets, but they really score on the play after the play. What really happens is that set gets them into some drive and kick, and then they score out of advantage. Okay, so we got to keep them neutral, right? Whether that's a scram switch or that's switching to neutralize the screen. But I would just challenge coaches, where do they actually score the ball from? And then looking at personnel, less is way more in this regard. I've seen and been guilty of the scouting reports with just paragraphs or sentences on the opponent. Here's the way I would handle that now. I'd like to hear your thoughts on this. I had a coach actually ask me for feedback on his scout, and he had icons, which I thought was pretty cool, right? Best player had a star, a shooter had a picture of a guy shooting. Post player had, you know, like, you know, picture of Shaq or something. We're very clear. We use colors, green shooter, red driver. If he could do both, it would be green, red. If he was kind of a shooter first, driver second. If he was a driver first, shooter second, it'd be red, green. So we've done all those. I think that gives me a very clear picture on who they are, kind of bird's eye view. But I think focusing on how to defend will tell your team what they do well, right? So we've got to make sure we, you know, close this player off. Okay, well, he's a shooter, right? Also, here's something that I haven't used yet. I probably would use it, and I'm interested to hear your feedback on this one. What did you do best, Coach? What, you were a shooter first?
I mean, let me tell you a story since it's about myself.
All right.
Big status. I don't know. You asked me. Okay. Through high school, I was driver first. I was pretty athletic for my size, rim, and not a very good shooter. Got to college and playing bigger defenders and had to become a shooter, and then became a shooter as well. And then in teaching shooting after playing retirement, I personally became a much better shooter from having taught shooting for 20 years, but started as a driver first. Like as a high school senior, shot 22% from the 3-point line.
That's up not good.
The state tournament. That's not good. Very willing though. Very willing. Thanks for asking.
Volume shooter.
Volume.
Okay. So let's take high school you.
Mm-hmm.
What if we were playing against a driver and it said number 10, Tyler Costin.
Mm-hmm. It was 23, but you know.
Well, no. So our opponent, I'm with you on 23. I love the number.
Okay.
But let's say we're guarding, me and you are on the same high school team, and our coach tells us number 10 equals Tyler. Mm-hmm. Well, I guard you every day in practice. So all I have to do is when I see number 10, I'm like, okay, how would I guard Tyler? I'm going to give him a little bit more space, right? And then that way, to me, I think that communicates a whole lot in a, and it's very relatable to players. If we were playing against you now, maybe you're a shooter first, right? Mm-hmm. So if we had a, you know, use the Rondo, Kobe, Allen, same thing, but use your team. I think that gives you a really clear.
I like that.
Yeah.
Never heard that before, but I that makes sense to me.
And I this really happened. When I was preparing scouts, that's a huge part of being a college coach, right? You're just, you always have your scout. Once you finish one, you're on to the next one. And you probably watch more film than what you need to. My barometer on like when I needed to watch film is when I'm watching the film and I already know what's going to happen before it happens, right? So ball goes out of bounds. Okay, they get into a box alignment. Okay, they're going to cross screen and duck in the bit. Oh, that's what they did. Okay, I feel like I'm pretty prepared now, right? Sometimes, you know, you got to over prepare depending on your staff, right? And I found myself watching film and just comparing them to our players. I'm like, well, I would just guard this player like teams guard our player. Why can't we just say this name? To me, it takes 3 seconds to communicate that. And in our scout stuff, that's what I would start to say. You know, we had a player that was a really good driver, downhill driver. Her name was Janae. And I found myself saying like, hey, just guard her like you'd guard Janae. And they're like, oh, okay, that's easy. So I've never done it before, but I probably would if I was coaching today.
I think that, okay, so if you're listening, please try it and give us feedback. Yeah, that's really good. Okay, let me riff off that. I have two thoughts. I think this one fits in first. Let me ask you a question. You're playing pickup, okay? How many possessions into the pickup game does it take for you to recognize the type of player that you're matched up against and what they do well?
Three,
okay. So if our players can't recognize it within three possessions, if they're not smart enough to do that, A, we haven't really taught them the proper approach to defense and awareness. We've been too positional. We've been too, this is what you do in our defense, as opposed to this is the outcomes we want from our defense. All right. And two, if they can't recognize it within three plays, they definitely aren't the type of player that's going to remember the scout. Right. So my argument is, and I know that this is drastic. I really like to interpret things for the majority of teams, not the teams. Like if you were to show Rajon Rondo or LeBron James 2 minutes of film on any player, that's going to be a lot less film than they're watching on players to prepare anyway. So what am I going to tell those guys? Nothing. Right. So that's that end of the spectrum, which is the minority of teams.
Yep.
The majority of teams, they're either going to recognize it within three possessions, or they won't change anything about how they play because they don't have the mental capacity yet to even recognize those cues or to know what to do with the information. So it's useless anyway. So I would actually argue that player scouts are useless for the majority of players. Now there's a few in the sweet spot there that could actually do something with the information that might save you one play early in a game until they get burned by something that a player does. But for the majority of the season, I would say absolutely useless for the majority of teams, which might be a hot take.
Yeah, no. I don't think it is. To me, it's not, because what mm-hmm. we did for the entire season, unless you were just a huge outlier, we closed you, like for shooting, we closed you off. That's it. Everybody asks, well, what if they can't shoot? I kind of don't care, because we're going to play the way we play. Teams are going to adapt to us. And I'm banking on the fact that we do way more decision-making and skill work than you do. So even if that player is not a shooter, if we close them off, we're forcing him into a decision.
Yeah.
And that's what I'm willing to give up. I'm not willing to give up rhythm threes. I'm not willing to give up layups, but I'm willing to give up players that can dribble into a decision and make the right one and make us pay for that. Right.
Absolutely.
And if you, let's say high school you, that was not a willing shooter, mm-hmm. this guy shoots 22% and he knows he's a 22% three-point shooter, his coach is going to take him out if he shoots, then closing off doesn't mean we have to run him off the line. It just means we got to be in the zip code so it can look different. Mm-hmm. And like we said, if we're doing that, then we're developing players that can figure that out. That's what I do when I go play pickup, right? After the third time my guy touches the ball, if he doesn't shoot it, I'm like, okay, I really don't have to close him off or out. I can just kind of hang back.
Yeah, agreed. And I'll say this it's why we created Lock Left the way we did, is to eliminate scouts and eliminate thinking. Same thing. We're going to close everybody off. We're going to make them dribble. And I would argue that, especially at the high school level, if someone can't shoot, they're actually probably someone that we want to have to make decisions on the move, because shooting is a sign of spending a lot of time in the gym. Like, usually shooting is a sign that you know the game and can do other things as well. So like, what are the types of players that can't shoot? Well, one type of player is the unskilled big. So if you can't shoot, then let's put them in on the move, dribbling decision-making situations. Okay, what's the other type of player that can't shoot? The really athletic player that's gotten by on athleticism and not skill. They also don't have the ball skills and the passing skills and the vision, right? Like, it's very rare that there's a type of player that's a non-shooter but unbelievable decision maker on the dribble. And the only players like that are usually the opposing team's point guard occasionally. And that's going to be a player that is going to be their best player or second best player anyway. So I just think that you can't get hurt by just making everyone make a decision on the move. Okay, second thing, maybe this story will be interesting to some coaches, maybe it won't. Scouts in college. So here's how most college staffs do scouts. Because there's so many teams to prepare for and apparently so little time to spend the hours and days required to scout, it rotates. And so like each coach on staff gets a turn for their scout. And they then prepare the team for their scout. And for many of these assistant coaches, it is their only moment in the sun. It's the only time that they actually get to talk or lead something. And assistant coaches are very proud of what their team's record is on their scouts versus the opposing coach's scouts. So it's like a big thing. Yep. And the coaching staff cares more about the scouts than the players. So I was actually working with one of our coaches, an assistant coach, Oregon, with, and they were telling me, like, I'm so annoyed and frustrated. Like, for my scouts, the players don't even listen to me. Like, they don't respect me, right? And like, and saying like, when I, and then when I ask them questions, they just like, don't even acknowledge it. She's like, we have a culture problem. And I said, okay, yes, probably, but I think you also have a scout problem. Like if they're zoning out and tuning out on your scout, then they definitely are zoning out on everyone's scout. And that probably means that it's not engaging enough. It's too complex, et cetera, et cetera. Like, I'm like, how long are you talking to your scout? She's like, 45 minutes. I'm like, oh dear. Like, like what do you have to talk about for 45 minutes and who's listening for 45 minutes? So anyway, I mean, that's, I think, why scouts have grown so long. And like a coach I respect a ton in the game, you probably interact with Bob Starkey as well. Mm-hmm. Like he has one of probably the most well thought out scout packets, his scout templates, all that stuff, right? So like he's been doing this a long time, incredibly successful. And I think it's way too much. And so like, you know, I think sometimes we have way more time on our hands than we know what to do with. And so don't assume that because you spend a lot of time on something that's productive, don't confuse like effort or don't confuse activity with efficiency.
Yeah. Couple thoughts on scouts, because I 100% agree. They are for the coaches because that's the assistant coach's time in the limelight, right? That's the time they get up and speak in front of the team. But here's what I would recommend, because this has come up. We would have I had my staff write their own job description. So a lot of times I got a new coach or our coaching staff is shuffling around. I'm thinking about having this coach in charge of scouting or this coach in charge. And I'm like, well, have you asked them if that's what they want to do? So have your coaches write their own job description. When I did that, I would have a coach say, I want to scout opponents. Got the high school level, you know, not quite as intense as the college level, but again, the college level is probably intense just because they feel like they have to be. So I said, yeah, sure. You know, but this is like May, this kind of, you know, end of season, off season. Here's two films on this team. Make me a scouting report in May or June and let me see it. That way I'm not worried about one, the standard at which they create the scout. But what I'm really checking for is consistency. And even at the college level, I've seen programs that Coach A presents and they might be using nines and sevens for, you know, hey, this player really is only going to shoot sevens. And then the next scout, the assistant coach, is saying, this player is only going to shoot wide open threes. Mm-hmm. Well, why are we not all saying sevens, right? So to combat that, I would have the scout coach, if I was the head coach, present it to me before we present it to the team. Mm-hmm. That way, if it's 45 minutes, I could say, great, give me the best 10% of that. Or you mentioned this, I think it's correct, but can we use this language instead? Especially as coaching staffs change. That's the great thing about having continuity on the staff is you don't have to do that, right?
Mm-hmm. No, I'm glad you hit on that. Language is so key. Like one of the worst things that you can do as a staff is for a player to come off the floor in a game and head coach to say, hey, you got to focus on A. Then they go and sit down and assistant coach runs up and say, hey, you got to focus on B. Right. And then players on the bench are like, hey, you should really go and do C. Well, all of a sudden, like their focus has changed. And most players and people remember the last thing they heard, not the most important thing they heard. And they're going to go out there and do C. And the head coach is like, what? I told you to go do A. I'm like, well, I was out here focusing on C. And so like, it's very important that assistant coaches, head coaches, even your team is aligned. I mean, one of the things that is, that I coach most aggressively on the bench in games is when player shoots what we'll call a five, a so-so shot, just 50-50. And they're like, great shot. Keep shooting after a miss. I'm like, shut up. Like, don't you dare say that. That is a terrible shot. Right? Like maybe nothing, but like I'm coaching. I'm like, you do not say that's a good shot. We have to be aligned on this stuff. Yeah. Right. And even with assistant coaches, either I'm talking to them or the assistant's talking to them. And the assistant has to confirm with me what they're talking to them about. So if I bring a player off the court, I'm like, hey, talk to them about wolfing the ball better. Like I'm directing that, right? Or like a player subbed off a couple weekends ago and assistant coach Claire, she's like, I'm going to work on the wall. I said, good, right? So like it's one thing and we're aligned on it. Like I'm not wondering what correction is being given to the players. Like, we're completely aligned and there's that communication. Like last night at practice, we have a new assistant we're onboarding, and we're working on rebounding, and he was measuring erases for our Dragons as they're required to erase, which is basically our boxing out. And he was like, okay, what does it mean to erase? Like, I've never heard that word before. Right. I'm like, well, I do not want you to ever say box out to a savvy team because we don't box out. Erase means you use forearm or forearms to erase or remove them from the rebounding equation with your eyes not going to the ball, eyes only going to your player. And so like now, like we're aligned and he's like erase, he's teaching erase. And there's one of our players on every team that's going to get better at that thing. And so like that type of holding the standard, I think is imperative to be speaking the same language.
Yeah. I love the, assistant going to the head coach saying, hey, I'm talking about this. Yes. Right on. I love that. Mm-hmm. I had a quick story. This was kind of funny. When I was a head coach, I had put in a sophomore into a game, to a varsity game early in the season. And he just came out jacking like suspect shots. Right. And I'm like, man, what has gotten into this guy? And, so he kind of plays for a couple of minutes and I'm like, I don't, you know, is he freaking out or what? So I take him out. And, after the game, we're debriefing as a staff, just kind of, I forgot we win, loss, doesn't matter, but we're kind of talking. And I was like, man, what got into so-and-so today? And one of my assistants was like, well, I told him like, hey, if you get in the varsity game, like, you got to get as many shots up as you can. And I'm like, well, that's not why I was putting him in the game. So consistency and communicate. I was just like, hey, don't do that again. We needed him. He was in there to give, you know, one of our starters like 2 minutes of rest, and he got like 7 shots up. Yeah. So I think being on the same page, I think coaches struggle with delegating or giving assistants ownership, but there's also a consistent message and voice and communication.
Yeah. And I think too, like with assistants, the more you can align and provide them ownership on specific things, then you can like check those off of your mind and they can narrow their focus as well. So like my guy Caleb, like his job is to improve our rebounding effectiveness within this system. And, you know, he knows that he is only having one-on-one conversations when someone's subbed out or during a break and play. And that would be the same rule for practice or games. Like, he will give no concurrent feedback in games during gameplay. But he can focus in on that one thing during a dead ball situation, walking in and out of a timeout, all that stuff. So I know what he's saying. And he's, you know, he's given the freedom to say that. Or, you know, Claire's working on our on-ball defense and their technique and their ability to channel ball left early. Right. We know that. Right. And there, and then I can be focused in on, you know, like our more systematic stuff. And so I think the clarity you can have of that will help everyone flourish, just like players flourish with clarity of roles.
Yeah. I love that. Yeah. Clear roles. And then, you know, everything's taken care of. We would have, you know, we would be locked in on certain things that we were looking at in the game. And one thing that always irked me in coaching is, like, assistants are always like, how can I get to this player first? Or, you know, I feel a strong need to go tell this player something. And it's like you said, they're probably getting, you need to do A, you need to focus on B, you need to focus on C. I'll share one last thing. I know we're about out of time here. Some of the best advice I got with giving assistants ownership is you have to let them fail sometimes. And that's your job as a head coach, is to mentor them in the process. I would, if I saw something not to our standard, I would either go and fix it and end up doing most of the work myself until I got that advice. And it's just like, look, if we don't have something, like let's say assistant coach is setting up a game or a drill in practice, and I could have done it in 30 seconds and they took 5 minutes to do it, I'm not going to cut them off. I'm not going to big league them. I'm not going to remove that responsibility from them. I'm going to mentor them in the process and just say, hey, if you could do that over again, how could you be more concise? You know, or here's some feedback for you. And I feel like coaches run away from that. So they end up taking on more, and then their assistants by end of the year or figureheads not doing anything. So gotta let them fail so you can mentor them.
Yep. No, that's good. And the more you teach someone else to do something, the better you'll actually do it yourself as well. I mean, one of the best ways to learn is to teach. And so like a lot of coaches that we work with, I'm sure you've heard this a bunch as well. I was on with one of our coaches and he just shared, he said, you know, I haven't had an opportunity to say this. I don't really have a mentor in my life. I consider you guys as savvy my coaching mentors, you know, and he was like, thank you for that. And I said, that's an honor. And I just said, be sure that you're paying it forward. And actually, because if you've never had a mentor, like how can you be that for somebody else? You know, and I think that's the challenge I would like to leave everyone that's going to be listening to this is, all right, if this has blessed you in any way, you know, Mark and I sharing ideas, make sure you pay that blessing forward and do what Mark just suggested and grow up the other coaches as well. It always blows my mind when coaches say, hey, don't work with anyone else in my league, or, you know, don't, you're right. And it's like, oh, what are we doing here? You know what I mean? Like, yeah, we all want to go win. But I think our bigger mission and hopefully savvy coaching's bigger mission is to grow the game. You grow the game by growing coaches. So let's make each other better. And I think we'll all end up winning because a rising tide raises all boats.
Absolutely. My wife sent me this the other day, and I was going to share it with you, so I'll share it with you now. It said something to the effect of like Kobe Bryant had a coach. You know, Bill Gates had advisors. You know, MLK had mentors. And then it went on to say, like, if your coach doesn't have a coach, get a different coach. If your therapist doesn't have a therapist, get a different therapist. So we should all be learning from somebody. I love that. Pay it forward. Coach the coaches, coach each other.
Awesome. It was great hanging out with you today.
Yeah, enjoyed it. Thanks for joining me again.